people who are not going to talk about it. So the last burning ember of a free press are our college newspapers. So I urge your listeners to go to any college that near them and tell them about this. It's free. We're not affiliated with any political party or anything else. We're just doing it to try and keep a free press alive.
I support that, and I also support nonprofit radio, and that's another voice that's still going because it's listener-supported. It doesn't get money from Ford Corporation or any corporation. Yeah. From California, we've been speaking with culture bender, filmmaker, activist David Obst. You can find links to his new book at ecoshock.org or check out www.stopbigcar.com.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Just before we get the inside scoop on killer algae blooms, let us stop to remember one of the great women of our times. Jane Goodall passed away last week at age 91. She was indeed good for all. Exploring and then living with African apes from chimpanzees to the great apes, Jane did more than teach us about other intelligent life here on Earth. With that mirror, she taught us about ourselves. She was kind and wise for decades as her documentaries thrilled kids and grown-ups. Here is a clip of Jane Goodall at a conference as played on Radio EcoShock in 2006.
I haven't met a single problem where there wasn't a person or usually a group of dedicated, passionate people who are prepared to give up almost everything, who work for no money, who risk their health, who risk their lives and sometimes lose their lives to try and put these problems right. And family planning is one of those problems which has taken people into far out places and sometimes put them in danger because there is so much opposition, so much lack of understanding. So it is this feeling that I sense around the world of an awakening of people who are understanding our backs are getting very close to the wall. And our Roots and Shoots program, all the people who are out there working on problems like family planning, other environmental problems, these are the army of people who can help us to make this a better world so that we do not destroy the last beautiful places of the planet for our future children. Because we need Mother Earth, we need the beauty of some of the wild places, and we need the beauty of the trees and the birds for our proper spiritual or psychological growth. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk at such a wonderful conference to such great people.
That was Jane Goodall at a Bixby conference in May 2006. Jane, you showed us our better nature. In May 2025, brown foam took over the beaches near Adelaide, Australia. That toxic bloom of algae grew to thousands of square kilometers, leaving masses of dead creatures behind. You may think harmful algal blooms are increasing with global warming, but is that true? Scientists who specialize in these blooms have been working on this problem for over a dozen years. In 2015, experts gathered to workshop and the summary paper was published, Harmful Algal Blooms and Climate Change, Learning from the Past and Present to Forecast the Future. Professor Mark L. Wells was the lead author then and again in 2023 for an update on the science. Mark is Emeritus Professor of Oceanography at the School of Marine Sciences, University of Maine. He is the co-chair of the section of harmful algal blooms of the North Pacific Marine Science Organization. From Maine, Mark Wells, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Yes, hello there, Alex.
Before we attempt the climate connections, let's get a few basics in place. We may think of plankton and algae in the same category, and hardly anyone understands why tall seaweed-like kelp is called algae and not a true plant. Mark, what is algae?
Well, algae, you've hit upon one of the basic, if you want, separations. We have what we call macroalgae. These are big pieces or big organisms that grow quite large. So you think about kelp, you think about seaweeds. These are macroalgae. There are also microalgae. They are different parts of the evolutionary chain, but essentially they're doing much the same thing. They photosynthesize and they grow. They build their biomass based on the use of photosynthesis and the nutrients that are in the water. Macroalgae may be attached to the bottom, but they don't have roots per se, so they're not like a tree or anything like that. When we talk about algae in general, we're covering both of those. But if you want the plankton, which are the microalgae, and we're talking about macroalgae. So it sometimes can be confusing, but you need to try and identify which of these groups that people really are meaning to talk about.
And just to add to the confusion, a type of bacteria is generally called blue-green algae. Is it algae? And would that be included in your reports on harmful algal blooms?
That's a great comment. And yes, they are. They are bacteria, so they're a different part of the evolutionary scale. But they use sunlight to photosynthesize, and therefore we think of them as phytoplankton, even though they are bacteria. And when we talk about harmful algae, particularly harmful algae in freshwater environments, most of those are the cyanobacteria, or some people will refer to them as blue-green algae because of they have a different set of pigments than, say, marine phytoplankton or a lot of the other phytoplankton, I should say.
And there are thousands of different kinds of algae, but only a few are harmful. Why is that? And how does algae become toxic?
Okay, so first I think we should clarify, when people talk about harmful algal blooms, in different parts of the world, they actually refer to them as red tides. And this was actually in North America, and much of the Western world, we used to talk about red tides as well, because certain types of algae, the pigments they have, make the water turn a red color when they get in high enough biomass, when there's enough of them there. Some of those red blooming organisms are what we consider harmful, and many are not. And so the idea of using red tides has sort of shifted now to harmful algal blooms. Now, when we talk about harmful algal blooms, you mentioned toxic. That's one of the categories of harmful algal blooms. The other ones are what we call high biomass blooms. In other words, where the phytoplankton grows to such an extent that when they die and sink to the bottom, the degradation of that biomass leads to oxygen deprivation, and basically you end up with large parts of the marine realm dying off because of a lack of oxygen. Most of what we were talking about in the report you mentioned is with regard to toxic algal blooms.
Why are these blooms considered important enough to draw attention from specialists?
Well, basically, when we talk about harmful algal blooms, we're making a societal decision about this. I mean, these they're part of the natural system. These organisms, you asked earlier, what makes them toxic or why are they toxic? They produce compounds that we don't know in all cases, we don't know why they produce these compounds, but if these compounds get concentrated in the food web, say if you're looking at a good example, would see if you're eating shellfish, like for example, bivalves, mussels or oysters, these feed on the phytoplankton, and you know, there's not enough toxin in a few phytoplankton to be harmful to us, but when you start having an organism that feeds on many millions of these every hour, then that toxin can sometimes be concentrated within the shellfish, and so we get a much higher dose. And the reasons why they produce that, we don't understand, but it's part of the natural system. And as you say, though, there's only a relatively small group of these organisms that are harmful to us. And so those are the ones that we focus on.
Could you give us an example of a classic case of a harmful bloom that happened and its consequences?
Well, there are many cases where it doesn't matter whether you're in Europe, you're in Asia, whether you're in North America and Africa. Everywhere there are numerous cases where shellfish become toxic. And they become toxic because, as I say, of the phytoplankton they're consuming and the relatively small amounts of toxin in each organism that get concentrated in the organism, they're concentrated in the flesh of the organisms we eat. And a good example of that could say from North America, if you're on the west coast of North America, we have blooms of a group of organisms called Pseudomyces that produce a toxin called bimoic acid. There was massive blooms in 2015, moving all the way back 1989, there was a massive bloom. But these blooms can end up causing closures of fisheries. They end up with ecological impacts. Well, so you will end up having organisms higher up in the food web that either die or are impaired because of the concentration of those toxins moving up into the food web.
Has anyone kept good records of blooms, and if so, are they increasing over the past 40 years or not?
Well, that's really a good question, and one that we don't have as good an answer for you as we would like. The blooms have, in some areas, the toxic blooms have been increasing. On a global scale, there's a fairly recent report out, where they tried to statistically analyze these. The reports, because they are reported, certainly in all Western countries and most Asian countries, there are agencies that look at measuring the toxicity or measuring the amount of algal toxins in the seafood supply, and so we do have good records of those. There is no question that there's a lot more reports of toxic events over the past 20 years. The difficulty in trying to extract this statistically is that because there's been such an increase in the consumption of seafood, in the production of seafood, the harvesting of seafood, there's a lot more reporting. So what's not clear on a global scale is whether or not the actual abundance of toxic blooms have been increasing over, say, the past two decades, or it's simply that we're getting a lot better at reporting them. However, I can say that in certain regions, there's no question that there has been some increases in the frequency or intensity of these blooms over the past 20 years or so.
Well, I think we should point out it's more than humans and shellfish. We've got reports of dead mammals, a lot of big fish kills. We have dead stingrays on the bottom and other plants. Could you talk about the other impacts on natural systems?
Yes, certainly. So from the toxic algal bloom perspective, you're absolutely right that as those toxins get concentrated, bioconcentrated up into the food web. And so in other words, the higher up you go in the food web, the greater the toxicity of the organisms that's being consumed, okay? Because the toxins are what we call lipophilic, or they're fat soluble. And so they are retained by the organism and concentrated in higher and higher levels. So, yes, you get, for example, sea lions off the west coast of North America. During Pseudomyces blooms, you'll see they'll go into grand mal seizures because that's one of the effects of the toxin domoic acid is attacks the brain. And that's because they're consuming anchovies or herring in some cases that have been consuming the algae and concentrating the toxins within the flesh. And so there really can be ecosystem-wide impacts as a consequence of these what we call harmful algal blooms. But the initial definition or the initial reason we started talking about harmful algal blooms was because of their effect on humans. And the study of the effect of these organisms in the broader ecosystem has only really been expanding over the past, let's say, decade or so.
Now, in another field, when it comes to hurricanes, we know big storms get faster when seas are warmer, but the scientists I talk to still don't know what actually triggers hurricane formation. Is that true of algae blooms? Do we know why they happen?
We know very well why the algal blooms in general happen, but as you pointed out, there are tens of thousands of species of marine phytoplankton. However, there's only less than 100 of those that produce toxins that are harmful to us. Now, the real question is, what causes those particular species to bloom? And while we can understand why blooms happen, we really can't understand why certain species bloom when they do. It's still an area of very, very active but difficult research.
Has your group looked into human influences in formation and seriousness of harmful blooms aside from global warming?
Yes, so that's a really good question. The biggest way that humans can interact, say directly, in a local ecosystem is by changing the amount of nutrient inputs. And so there has been a lot of study looking at the effect of nutrients such as nitrate and phosphate inputs as a consequence of industrial, human sewage, etc., into the coastal waters and what those impacts are. In virtually all of those cases, you know, the impacts are in creating larger biomass blooms. And so you can generate harmful algal blooms that are high biomass blooms. However, the linkages between nutrient inputs and toxic bloom occurrence, in other words, does this stimulate the toxic species to bloom, there really, so far, is no good evidence that that would be, that's what's happening. So we know that we can have an influence on the system, but we don't yet understand, or we don't yet have evidence that our impact, direct impact on the system, is triggering specifically the toxic algal blooms.
So, the big question everyone wants to know, will global warming lead to more or worse harmful algae blooms in the future?
Yeah, that's the question that's attracted a lot of, a huge amount of interest in my field. But let me put it this way. We understand why certain types of phytoplankton bloom at different times. Many of the toxic species that bloom are of a phytoplankton division called dinoflagellates, or basically the fire plants, because they, at night, for example, when there's high biomass of dinoflagellates around, you will see a bioluminescence of the water. Now, most of the toxic blooms are really derived by dinoflagellate blooms, okay? Toxic dinoflagellate blooms, of which, as I say, there's probably less than 50 species out of the thousands of dinoflagellates that occur in the marine environment. Now, basically, what we find is that those species, when they bloom, they end up, they will end up blooming at either at low concentrations. In other words, a bloom isn't necessarily really high abundance of phytoplankton. I'll give you an example, say, off the coast of Maine, for example, the toxic blooms there are dinoflagellates. The shellfish become toxic when the cells reach something on the order of 100 cells per liter, which is tiny. It's very hard to find them, but the oysters will be filtering enough seawater that they collect enough of that toxin. When we look at, say, the coast of Maine, what we see is the temperature of the ocean surface has been rising. Now, when temperature rises, it becomes basically more like summertime. And when we tend to find these blooms of, say, these dinoflagellates, they occur primarily in the summer. So they are well adapted to those summer-type conditions where the nutrient concentrations tend to be lower because phytoplankton earlier in the year have used them up. And so what we would project is that you're going to end up having more dinoflagellate blooms as we move into the future because the surface waters are warming. So the nutrient levels will end up being lower, and as a consequence, it's those type of species that do well. Now, while we could intuitively project and expect that there'll be a lot more dinoflagellate blooms, we suspect that that's also going to include the toxic species. So the expectation is that we will end up having more toxic algal blooms from the dinoflagellate groups. It may be that we have less toxic blooms from other groups that aren't as well adapted to those warming conditions.
Reading through the science, I began to wonder, are harmful algal blooms like weeds? I mean, weeds pop up when biosystems have been disturbed, say, by a fire. In this case, it's not so much that climate change causes a harmful outbreak, but damage to competitive communities leaves the field more open to them. What do you think?
Yeah, it's an interesting analogy. I don't like using the word weeds for them because really they are part of a natural part of the system, and like when we say harmful, weeds has sort of a subjective view on it. But nevertheless, your point is a good one. Is that as the conditions change, basically you're making okay, if we can put, think of it this way, you could take an analogy of a group of, say, 100 people. Well, they all have different food tastes. They like different types of food more than other types of food. They'll eat all of the food, but they do better when, or they enjoy more when they eat certain types of food. Well, as your system changes, your ecosystem changes, in essence, you're changing the situation such that some species are going to end up being able to do better than other species. Not that the other species can't grow, it's just that the ones that do the best will grow the fastest, and therefore they'll tend to end up dominating the communities. At least that's what we call a bottom-up perspective. In other words, what might allow certain species to grow better than others.
So a big bloom shows up near the coast, and it's reported in the local news. What comes after? Do the former plankton and bacteria and larger species return and recover, or does a new complex of living things develop?
No, basically what happens is that in virtually all cases, what you'll see is that the system resets itself again. You can think of this in a seasonal basis, okay, if you're dealing with, say, temperate waters or mid-latitude regions. You go into the wintertime, and that basically resets everything so that the new spring comes up and you end up with slightly different sets of conditions, and so you never tend to get exactly the same species dominating all, each year. There's always some mixtures. So it's not like we've transformed the system entirely if climate change is going to have this impact. It's more that we're making it more likely that certain species will end up becoming present in higher numbers more frequently than in the past, but not necessarily every year.
In another study published in The Lancet in 2023 by Chris C. Lim, they looked into harmful algal bloom aerosols in human health. Can bits of the toxic bloom float inland and into our lungs?
Yeah, that's another great question. There are some species of dinoflagellates that you can think of, basically the cell is like a grape, okay? It has an outer surface, okay, a membrane on the outer surface. Now, in some and in some cases, that membrane is reinforced with some we call it armor, but basically it's like thin wood, if you will, lignin-based, cellulose-based plates that help protect the organism. So if they've got the armor, they're tougher. The grape won't break, okay? But if they don't have armor, then if you get into high turbulence environments, you can actually break the cell up, okay? So this is what happens with some cells in say, surf environments, where you have the waves come in, they hit the surf, it's high turbulence, the cells can be broken up. The material that's in the cell that contains the toxin then can become aerosolized, and so it'll transport with the water droplets along the shore, and they can be inhaled, and they will have an impact on people. So, for example, in Florida, one location where they will put out warnings that because the harmful algal bloom is coming on shore and it's a particular type of species that they know is going to break up in the shore environment, they'll forecast for people perhaps to stay away from the beach areas.
Well, these events can bring widespread damage. I'm thinking of drinking water, ocean species killed, maybe aerosol harms, as we've talked about, tourism lost, fisheries income lost, and more. But so far, if we can't predict how toxic blooms will change with climate, isn't this a dangerous thing not to know as warming speeds up?
Well, absolutely. What you'll find is that there have been very few studies looking at the overall economic impact from blooms, but they basically move through society. So you have the fisheries. So who is doing the harvesting of the fisheries? Well, if you have to shut the fisheries down because of the toxic level in whatever that fishery is, whether it be bivalves or other, then those producers or those fishermen are obviously hit hard. But then it comes to the suppliers of the materials that they need for fishing, and they are hit hard. You have the tourism side where they close beaches, and so now suddenly people don't show up. And so the cascading economic impacts can be huge. Forecasting these events is really, if you want, that would be the gold standard that we all strive towards. But because we don't understand at this stage what triggers the toxic species from appearing in sufficient quantities to become harmful, we can't forecast it. We can make general forecasts, So I'll go back to the state of Maine, for example. We know, we can forecast every year you're going to have closures due to the presence of toxins. We can't forecast where those closures will be, what parts of the coast of Maine. We can't forecast when it will be, down to the point of, say, weeks or something like that. But we can say that every summer you're going to end up having closures. And unfortunately, that's about as good as we can do for the most part.
Well, one of the purposes of these workshops and your summary papers is to answer that key question. What kind of research could provide the best answers in the shortest period of time? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so, you know, the thing is, we've been studying harmful algal blooms for decades, and we've been looking at them from the point of view of the cell, primarily. What is it about the cell? Why do they produce the toxins? What are they using the toxins for? We grow them in culture, and we study how they grow and how the toxin level may change as they grow. We study, to some extent, what the occurrence of them in the coastal environment. In most cases, we're using those same records that I mentioned that are being kept by agencies for food safety. But what we haven't been doing as much, we are now, over the past, say, certainly 5 years, we're starting to look a lot more intensely at what factors of changing climate might influence the relative competitive ability of these phytoplankton, And the problem is that if you want to, say, look at temperature, all these species, like your houseplants, they all have an optimal temperature, but they have quite a temperature range over which they can grow. And the optimal temperature range for many species is very similar, the toxic versus the non-toxic. So temperature alone is not going to drive into a toxic bloom. The same thing with nutrient levels. There isn't that much difference. So it's probably down more on some of these finer aspects. And this is where the climate change impact is likely to occur. So we are starting now to try and get a better idea about how some of these other factors may help, if you want, bolster a certain, say, toxic species from becoming more successful than the non-toxic compatriots in the same water.
From Maine, we've been speaking with harmful algal bloom expert Dr. Mark Wells. You can find links to all the science we just talked about in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Mark, thank you for spending time with our listeners. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to speak with everyone.
I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening again this week and caring about our world.
All right, bravo. One more car destroyed.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. Climate change has become a charged partisan issue in the U.S., but conservative environmentalist Benji Backer hopes to change that.
If there's one issue that should be nonpartisan, it should be protecting the Earth, protecting our homes, protecting our communities, and making sure that we have a livable planet for future generations.
Backer is the founder of Nature is Nonpartisan. It's a coalition of people from across the political spectrum who care about climate change and are working to make bipartisan progress on the issue. He says opportunities exist, even in the midst of today's divisive politics. For example, Americans widely support protecting public lands, restoring forests to reduce the risk of wildfire, and increasing coastal communities' resilience to disasters. So through the Nature is Nonpartisan website, people can write to their representatives and urge them to take action on these issues. Backer says it can be challenging to work across the aisle.
Our staff is half liberal, half conservative. Same with our board. Everything we do is intentionally split across the political spectrum. It isn't easy. We're always straddling this balance of trying to represent people's priorities, knowing that we have the same end goal.
But he says finding common ground is critical in order to make lasting progress. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Listening to CJSF and 90.1 FM in Burnaby. CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours, sharing music and voices from genres and cultures around the world, reflecting you and the rest of your community.
You make CJSF diverse.